In business, first impressions are everything. And that's why every business owner needs to know about Ruby. Ruby is the virtual receptionist company who screens, transfers, and takes messages 24/7, all while making your customers feel special. You definitely don't want to hire a subpar front desk person. And with Ruby, they engage with your callers in a conversational way, just like your best employee would. Never miss another customer call again. This year, make your business the best it can be. Visit ruby.com today. Or just call them at 844-900-RUBY. Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
Hey, everybody in Orlando. We feel pretty sure that you've heard the news, but if you haven't, our show that was postponed has been rescheduled for Friday, September 8th, which is great news.
Yeah, it is great news. If you thought a Saturday show was going to be great, wait until you see us on a Friday, Orlando.
That's right. And the venue should have gotten in touch with you by now. Your tickets are still good. If you cannot go, we're very sad. But you can get a refund on that. And hey, if you're available now on Friday, September 8th, come and see us in Orlando.
Yeah, tickets are still available, and you can get all the information you need by going to linktree/SYSK or stuffyoushouldknow.com and check out our on-tour page. And we'll see you September 8th.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh. There's Chuck. Jerry's here too. And this is Stuff You Should Know, part of our ongoing musical saga. It's frequently overlooked, but when we do them, man, we hit them out of the park. Remember the one where we talked about pitch and we got every single thing we could have possibly gotten wrong?
I file this more sort of in the same category as the great episodes we did on Les Paul and Leo Fender.
Yeah, music.
Yeah, but, why you got to bring up our worst music one?
What else have we done? We've done some other musical stuff, haven't we? We've done, like, actual genres, punk and hip-hop and...
Yeah. Disco?
Yes, great one.
You love that one.
We have a robust musical suite going, and this adds to it, I think. This is a good idea on your part, because we're talking about a guy who I always thought his first name was John, and I couldn't figure out why, and then I realized that...
Jurassic Park.
His name was John Hammond.
That's funny. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. So his name actually isn't John. It's Lawrence, but I think you pronounce it like Lawrence, but it's spelled Lorenz.
Yeah. I've heard Hammond. Lorenz Hammond.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's very...
But he went by Larry, so let's just call him Larry.
Yeah. That's why I thought they probably pronounced it Lawrence. But if you recognize his last name, not from Jurassic Park, but from the electric organ, because he was... indisputably the inventor of the electric organ. He was the first guy to really put everything together and make it work.
That's right. Specifically, obviously, the Hammond organ, and very much notably, the Hammond B3, which was one of the organs in his line of organs. And if you are a piano player or an organist, a keyboard person, then you're like, oh, yeah. Speak to me, baby. If you are not, and you're like, Hammond B3, what's that? It is the sound of rock and roll. It is Refugee by Tom Petty and half the songs of Boston. And
oh, yeah?
It's, you know, the big organ solo and the big Boston suite. Mm-hmm. It is Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan and Wider Shade of Pale by Procol Harum. It is in so many songs that you know and love, one of the more, and that's not to mention, you know, jazz and everything else that the Hammond B3 was used for, but it really made its mark on rock and roll in the 60s and 70s, even though it was built and created in 1935, and even though Larry Hammond, by all accounts, was tone deaf and did not play a note of any instrument ever in his life.
Yeah, I mean, that by his own admission, from what I understand.
It's like Leo Fender.
Yeah. I forgot about that, but yeah. One other, I think one other group that requires shouting, I think Dr. Teeth played a Hammond B3.
Of course. Absolutely.
I'm pretty sure. So, yeah, Larry Hammond didn't know what he was doing with music, but he knew what he was doing with engineering, specifically electrical engineering, which at the time he was studying this, he was born in 1895, started studying in the first couple decades of the 20th century. This was some brand new stuff. And this guy was at the bleeding edge of the whole thing.
Bleeding?
Which I used correctly, finally.
Did you say leading or bleeding?
I said bleeding.
No, bleeding is when it leads to bad things.
People have been electrocuted.
Okay, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So Hammond was born a young boy in just outside Chicago in the suburb of Evanston, Illinois, like you said, in 1895. And he was the only boy of four kids. He had three sisters, had a father who was a banker who died when he was two, and a mother named, this is a great name, Idea Strong Hammond, who was an impressionist painter and, you know, pretty accomplished and an artist and a creative. So once Mr. Hammond dies, when little Larry's just two, she says, you know what? I'm packing up my three girls and my son, and we're going to Europe where you can be submerged in the arts and get what I think is probably a more proper education.
Yeah, so from the time they moved there when he was four till the time they moved back to Evanston when he was 14, they lived in Geneva and Dresden and Paris. And one of the things about Larry Hammond was from an extraordinarily young age, he was a tinkerer. He wanted to know how things worked.
Mm-hmm.
And when they landed in Paris, I'm not sure exactly what age he was at the time. I think he was a tween possibly. But France was like, this was when the first cars were really being designed and built, and France was the epicenter of that. And little Larry Hammond happened to live there at the time, so he was taking apart engines from a very young age and actually came up with the crude version of an automatic transmission a decade before it was ever actually patented. That's what this was doing as a tween.
Yeah. Yeah, as a 12-year-old, he was incredibly brilliant, probably a genius. I know that word is thrown around a lot. But if you're doing that kind of thing when you're 12 in the early 20th century, then that qualifies in my book.
Yeah, I was putting on like half a bottle of Polo cologne and wandering around the mall at this age.
I was in the basement hiding from Satan.
There you go. That's another thing to do.
That's another thing to do. So the Hammonds were, like I said, they were all pretty accomplished. Well, the mom was pretty accomplished, and all his sisters would go on to do great things. His sister Eunice was a writer and a poet and edited a poetry magazine. His sister Louise was a missionary in China who would transcribe Christian hymnals and religious books in Chinese. And his sister Peggy was a musician. She was a cellist, a world-class cellist. But young Larry was not inclined musically. When they went back to Evanston, Illinois, he continued to sort of experiment and take things apart and put them back together. And eventually he got a little taste of success early on when he was 16. He got his first U.S. patent with a kind of a new and improved barometer that he ended up making a few hundred bucks off of, which, you know, was pretty good for a 16-year-old in the 20s at this point? Teens?
Yeah, he would have been, 1909.
Okay, yeah.
1911. Somewhere in there.
All right.
So, yeah, he ended up going on to college. I don't think there was ever any question whether he was going to or not, thanks to his mom and her strong will about education and work ethic. And he ended up at Cornell in Ithaca. And apparently, according to the Larry Hammond legend, he finally kind of came to understand his own maybe mission in life, if not brilliance. From what I read, he had a bit of an ego here or there, although he was generally a good guy. This story kind of jibes.
I've never known any genius inventors to have large egos.
Right.
It's unusual.
Usually very meek, and they hide in the basement from Satan, too.
That's right.
But he the night before exams, he and his friends went out to Syracuse and were drinking, and caught the last train back to Ithaca. And when they got to class, they were still kind of drunk. And Larry Hammond wandered into the wrong class, did he not? What happened after that, Chuck?
Well, apparently he went in on exam day to an electrical engineering class that he wasn't even taking and aced the final, or aced the exam. I don't know if it was a final. Yeah. And I think, like you said, as the legend goes, that's when he was like, huh, I'm a pretty smart guy and I am good at inventing things. And so that's what I'm going to dedicate my life to.
Yeah, he's not only that, he was going to be an independent inventor. That's a life choice right there.
Oh, right, like not going to work for GE or Westinghouse or whatever?
Right. And he didn't. He ended up going somewhere, I don't remember where. He had a couple of jobs for sure, especially to start out. But the first thing he did after Cornell was to go enlist in World War I.
Yeah.
And I think he was stationed in France for a little while, was mistaken for a French deserter because his French was so good. Another part of his legend. It's a good little story. But then after that, he moved to Detroit and he took a job. He became chief engineer. He's still very young at a company that made boat engines. Because remember, he had spent a lot of his tweens taking engines apart. He could ace an electrical engineering final, but he also was studying mechanical engineering at the time. So it makes sense that he was working at a company that made boat engines.
Yeah, and he was it was called the Gray Motor Company, and apparently the guy he was working for was someone that served with him in Army and said, I think it wasn't enough money or something, and under the table, this guy paid him an extra $300 a week that no one knew about just to keep him working on these boat engines.
Man.
Like that, he knew he was that valuable and that he probably shouldn't be making boat engines, so he greased the wheel, he greased the palm a little bit.
He greased the propeller. But remember, he wanted to be an independent inventor. And if you have the spirit of an inventor and the ego of somebody who can ace an electrical exam without taking the test, no amount of money is going to make you satisfied spending your life making boat engines for somebody else. So he struck out. And I think he did it the smart way.
Not struck out as in failed, like baseball.
No, the other way around.
Yeah, like struck out on his own.
Exactly.
Just so people know.
I think he was still working, though, and at night he was working on his own stuff. So this was while he was working at the boat company, from what I understand. But he came up with something called a tickless clock. Not ticklish clock, a tickless clock that you couldn't hear tick, because apparently that drove him crazy. And I feel this guy. If you've ever had a loud clock in the room with you while you're trying to sleep, there's nothing else you can concentrate on except the stupid ticking of that stupid clock.
Yeah.
And Larry Hammond felt the same way, so he invented one that didn't make the ticking sound.
That's right. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to sell this idea. He sold that idea, made some pretty good money on it, enough that he was able to move to New York and open up his own sort of invention factory. And he invented something there that kind of was the beginning of what would end up like informing his future career in a lot of ways. And that was the synchronous motor.
Mm.
In America at the time, this is the early 20s, they were making the switch to 60 hertz from 50 hertz.
Yeah.
Westinghouse came along and they had a lot of sway, obviously, and said, you know what? This arc lighting system we have looks a lot better at 60 hertz. We need everything to be the same. So United States, can we all move to 60 hertz? And the government said, sure.
Right. Yeah. So 60 hertz is 60 cycles a second. And it's part of alternating current, which, as we remember, won out the current wars because you can send it over very long distances with very little loss of energy, right?
Yeah.
So they switched over to 60 cycles a second, and Hammond said, well, wait a minute, that's precise. Like, we're talking about a precise, like, something is moving back and forth between the poles 60 times a second, and we're talking about electrons. You can set your watch by electrons, basically. So his synchronous motor plugged into that 60 cycle a second electrical current, and it created a motion that spun just as reliably as those electrons switch poles back and forth 60 times a second.
That's right. And if you're thinking, I don't even know what this means, guys, who cares? What this means is all of a sudden you can electrify things that were previously not electrified.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't know, that tickless clock that you still had to wind over and over. like every clock in the world that you had to wind over and over.
By the way, Chuck, that tickless clock, the way it was tickless is the motor was put into a soundproof box.
Yeah, pretty easy.
Which means that you could also say it was a tick in the box. Okay, so the synchronous motor, though, this was the fact that it was very precise, that it was going to spin X number of times every second. That was a really big deal, because if you have something that is that precise and that has is current is getting an electrical current that's keeping it that precise no matter what, you can do all sorts of things. Like you said, he had an electrical clock. You can make little shutters spin in front of people's eyes without them even realizing that they're spinning. All sorts of things you can do with a synchronous motor. And that was the basis of a lot of his inventions that followed.
All right. I think that was a great little tease setup.
I'm sorry for teasing you, everybody.
No, I love it, because people are going like, what do you mean shutters in front of your eyes? Well, we're going to explain that right after this. We'll be right back.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcometonow. Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids, because let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.
All right, so Josh left a great little tease.
Sorry.
I did mention that he started making these clocks, but this next thing actually happened first, because he did have a lot of success with the Hammond Clock Company, because everyone was like, these electric clocks are amazing. I don't want to wind my clock ever again.
Right.
And you don't have to. But before he found success there, he invented 3D movies in the silent era of cinema.
Insane. So remember from our Stereogram, our Magic Eye episode?
Yeah, this is perfect for this.
It is. It's basically the same stuff going on around the same time. But he came up with something called the Teleview. And you basically created a film with two cameras set a little bit apart. And now all of a sudden you've got two slightly different perspectives of the same thing, which, as you remember from our Stereogram episode, the eye loves to turn into depth and perspective, right?
Yeah.
So then you project the movie onto the screen using those two projectors, not overlapping, but alternating very quickly between the right image and the left image, right image, left image. That sounds like a headache, and it probably would be if it weren't for the viewers that that Hammond created, that every seat had, that you looked at this movie through. And when the left image was up on the screen, a shutter closed over your right eye. So all you could see was your left image. And then the same thing for your right eye with the right image. And this all happened so fast that your brain didn't make note of it. All it saw were two slightly different perspectives of the same thing and turned it into what's called parallax depth, based on your position of where you're sitting and where you're viewing an object.
Amazing. And again, this is all possible because of that synchronous motor, which was spinning these two little things in front of your eyeballs.
Exactly. Isn't that nuts? This was the 20s, and this guy came up with 3D, and it worked really well. It worked so well that people were a little put off by it.
Yeah.
I read an article from The Atlantic that was written in 1940, a profile of John Hammond. They said that the one movie that he made, Hello Mars, was so crystal clear that it says close-ups of love scenes were almost embarrassing. And you could see the sweat on the actors' faces. So yeah. Apparently it was distracting. It was so realistic and so lifelike that nobody was following the plot, and they were maybe even a little put off.
All right, so this isn't working out as far as being a great business idea, but he was like, you know what, I could make this thing without those little spinny goggles. He said, I could actually do it with colored lenses,
yeah.
These little cheap cardboard things that, you know, in 30 years, everyone is going to think is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And he did that. He created some for Ziegfeld himself and the Ziegfeld Follies, which was the biggest show going in vaudeville in New York. Mm-hmm. He called this the shadow graph, and he had actors standing behind a transparent screen, and he backlit them with a red and a green light spaced a few feet apart, and then projected their shadows on the screen. And when you wore those 3D glasses, it, again, created depth, and it looked like they were sort of leaping off the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And Ziegfeld loved this one. He was like, I'll pay you $75,000 to use this stuff for 2 years, mm-hmm. which is about $1.3 million today.
Do you know how many drachmas it is?
How many?
420,578,000
wow.
plus drachmas as
Amazing.
Of today.
Yeah. So, I mean, by this point, he's rich, or at the very least, he can use that money to fund doing whatever he wants to do invention-wise.
Being an independent inventor, he's realized his dream by this point.
That's right.
In the 20s. So he was in his 20s still. It's pretty great stuff.
Yeah.
Also, I saw that this is the only effect that Ziegfeld used over 2 seasons. Ziegfeld liked to keep things fresh and cutting edge, but mm-hmm. he loved the shadow graph so much that he used it over 2 different seasons, which is kind of an honor in and of itself.
Super cool.
So let's get back to that synchronous motor, the 60 cycle second that was so reliable you could never have to wind a clock from it, right?
All right.
Well, let's go back even further than that, Chuck. Let's go back to the 1890s, which is the same year Hammond was born, 1895. And there was an American inventor named Thaddeus Cahill, who was the first person to come up with an electromechanical, not strictly electronic, but it had some gears and stuff to it. So it was electromechanical. It's called the telharmonium. And well, let's go back even further than that, Chuck.
Okay.
To the 1860s, and we're going to hop on over to Germany.
All right. I'm picking up what you're laying down. There was a German scientist named Hermann von Helmholtz. And he knew music a little bit. And he's like, here's one thing I know. Is that when you hear a musical note, it's a sound wave that you're hearing, vibrating at a frequency. Like if you hear an A key on a piano, it's vibrating at a very specific frequency that makes the sound of what you would call an A note.
Right.
But here's the deal. He said it sounds more than an A note. It's very warm and there's depth to it. And he figured out what you're hearing is called a harmonic, which is, you know, when one thing vibrates, things near it are also activated and mm-hmm. maybe vibrate a little bit. And these little background frequencies vibrating along with that A note create this richer, fuller sound called a harmonic.
Yeah. So Helmholtz's big contribution in the 1860s is to chart all of these harmonics.
Yeah.
So I, from what I understand, then he would go through and say an A on a cello has all these accompanying vibrations. An A on a violin has all these different vibrations, and wrote them out as frequencies, right? So he created a scientific mathematic roadmap mm-hmm. to recreating those frequencies using something other than a cello or other than a violin. If you have that information and you can reproduce those frequencies together, they will make an artificial sound of a violin or an artificial sound of a cello. This is what Helmholtz contributed, which is pretty significant.
Hugely.
Now back to Cahill.
All right, so back to Cahill. Again, he was the American inventor who invented the first electromechanical, I don't even think you said musical instrument.
Did I just stop with electromechanical?
Yeah.
Man, what? Sloppy.
That was called, no, you're not, you're great. That's called the, that was called the telharmonium, and he created something called the tone wheel, and it was, you really should look it up. It's kind of hard to describe. It's this very large disc-shaped motor. It has cogs, and when you spin that rotor, the working with a magnet, like, you know, the same way you would with a electric guitar pickup, the cogs pass through a magnetic field by this coiled copper wire around the magnet. And if you spin it at a steady pace, it's going to generate a very specific frequency, an electrical frequency. Mm-hmm. And if you amplify that, that's where you're going to finally hear that musical tone come out that Helmholtz was talking about so many years earlier.
Yeah. So what if you have, say, 400 cogs on this tone wheel and they pass through the electrical field 400 times a second, it makes one full revolution per second. It will generate a current with a frequency of 400 hertz. And that is the same frequency as an A4 note. So what Cahill has just done is create a way to reproduce that A4 note or any note you want to if you can figure out what the frequency is, thanks to Helmholtz, and then build a cog that has that number of little prongs or something on it, thanks to Cahill.
Right. So what he did, like we mentioned, was create that telharmonium, which was sort of, like you said, the very first electromechanical instrument. But it was a problem because it was huge. It weighed 200 tons. It cost what would be $7 million today. And it was the size of a train car.
2.2 billion drachmas.
So obviously this thing's not going to sell. Nobody's interested in a telharmonium, but that really set the stage for Larry Hammond's work.
Definitely. So that, and that's a really important point for inventors to whenever you talk about an inventor, very, very rare that somebody comes up with a full idea from scratch. You know,
right.
They stand on the shoulders of giants, they always say. That's what Hammond did. He was the first person to figure out how to make this stuff practical. And he had the wit and the brains and the interest to make it happen. And so after Cahill basically gave up because he created a $7 million, 200-ton train car of a electromechanical instrument,
yeah.
Hammond was like, I'm going to pick this up. I never saw Chuck if he knew about Cahill's invention or how he knew about Cahill's invention or if he was inspired by Cahill. I'm not sure. I think that it was too... I don't know, but he basically took the tone wheel, however he heard about it, and he figured out how to make it much smaller, much more practical. Rather than the size of like a huge cylinder, it was the size of about a silver dollar. And when you get something that is that useful down to that size, you can put a bunch of them together and do some really amazing stuff. And that's what he did. That was the basis of the Hammond organ.
That's right. It didn't initially start out that way, though. He had been, like I said, selling a lot of electric clocks, was making pretty good money doing that. But then everybody started making electric clocks and his company wasn't as valuable all of a sudden. Mm. And I don't think we mentioned that he was an independent inventor, but he wanted to put people to work. Like he was very proud of supplying jobs to people.
Mm-hmm.
And he always wanted to have like a successful company, you know, certainly to enrich himself, but also so he could put people to work. I mean, this was, a lot of this stuff was during the Depression. A lot of his work was. So he was really proud of putting Americans to work. And I think Hammond eventually ended up having like 3,000 employees when the organ was at its peak, which was a really big deal to him. But the clock is slowing down, not literally. The business was, though, and he was a little nervous about what to do to keep the doors open. So he initially thought of this tiny tone wheel thing to just make like a sound and like, hey, it can be a gimmick, a little gadget, and you can have this little tone wheel and plug it in and it makes a sound and kids will love it, almost like a toy. But he had a assistant treasurer at Hammond that was a church organist. And the organist was like, man, you should make an organ. Like if you can make one sound, you can make a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Hammond like loved the sound of a pipe organ. And that was it. He had the other thing, which was kind of funny, that he was making a lot of money on that also went away, was this auto-dealing bridge table. It was a bridge table that under the table had a little mechanical system that shuffled and dealt cards literally under the table to each player. And he sold 14,000 of those.
Wow.
In 2 years, but then everyone got tired of that. So he was always looking for the next thing to keep the doors open. And this like, let's replicate a pipe organ was the next big thing.
Yeah. One other thing about him as a boss, too, and a company owner, he was smart enough to surround himself with other very smart engineers. And in particular, is a guy named John Hannert, who basically co-created the Hammond organ with Hammond. I almost have the impression that of the two, Hammond was the idea guy and Hannert was the one who figured out how to do it. But when you put them together, what they did was they took these tone wheels and at the behest of the organ playing treasurer at the Hammond company, realized that if you took 91 of them, you could essentially reproduce all the sounds that a pipe organ could make.
Yeah.
Which is really something, because a pipe organ can make quite a bit of very rich sounds, a lot of different sounds. That's kind of the point of a pipe organ. I didn't realize until researching this, is that it's meant to not only just sound like an organ, but it's also meant to mimic other instruments. And it does that by mimicking the timbre of a different thing. A timbre is like you were talking about, where if you play an A on a piano, it sounds different than an A on a cello. Well, mm-hmm. The difference is timbre. And if you can, again, figure out the harmonics surrounding that note, you can recreate what it sounds like on a piano in A or an A on a cello. And that pipe organs were able to do this. They did it using compressed air, mechanical stuff. John Hammond was the one who's like, I can take one of these giant things and size it down and make this whole, the same thing happen with electronics.
Yeah. It's like, you know, today, if you go buy a Casio keyboard,
mm-hmm.
it's going to say, you know, horns, strings,
right.
Flute, trumpet, guitar. And those things never sound, strings do a pretty good job. But, you know, when you hit the, if you play a series of horns, you're not going to say like, oh my gosh, is there a mariachi band in here?
Right.
It approximates the sound in a fun and useful way.
Even the samba beat's not going to dress that up enough to pass muster.
But you're right. At the very least, this was like a big deal. Pipe organs could do it to get different sounds that would, you know, like, hey, this is a flute or an organ version of a flute, essentially.
Yeah, they're called, those were the stops. Like you would pull a stop to let a rank or timbre of pipes play. You could close the stop to keep that one from playing and allow other ones to play. One of Hammond's big breakthroughs was to figure out how to do that, again, electronically.
Yeah, like if you've ever seen a pipe organ up close, they have these little round knobs,
mm-hmm.
and that's called a stop knob, and it's either on or off, and you pull it in or pull it out, and that's letting compressed or pressurized air in or out to change the sound.
I saw that that's where the term, the phrase pulling out all the stops comes from. When you have all the stops open, all the
wide
pipes
open,
are playing at the same time, which is, yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So Hammond figures all this out. He gets a piano, guts it. Installs platinum switches, installs 8.5 miles of wiring, installs hundreds of transistors,
mm-hmm.
and they are spinning these tiny tone wheel motors when you press a key. And it's pretty ingenious. So all of a sudden he's electrified this thing, even though he doesn't play a musical instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, instead of using these mechanical stops, he has these switches called tone bars. So if you ever see a Hammond organ and you see above the keys there, kind of where the stop knobs are in an organ, there are these little bars that you can just pull in or out, and it has the same effect, basically. And, you know, depending on who you are, you might have your favorite tone bar settings for different songs. I think the classic, like Jimmy Smith was this guy that was sort of really popularized it, jazz organ,
mm-hmm.
and everyone knows, like, this is the Jimmy Smith setting. Like if you go to YouTube and you're talking about different tone bar settings, they'd be like, oh yeah, Jimmy Smith pulled all three of these on the left out and that was his setting. And you can replicate this stuff. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So one of the things that Hammond was interested in doing too was rather than say, you know, make this combination and it's the strings, or make this combination and it's the flute.
Yeah.
He left it up to the person. So like those stops would have to do with like attack and decay, like how fast the sound started and how long it took to finally like go silent again.
Yeah.
These were like what the sound bars were doing. It wasn't like, oh, I'll press this button and now it's a string. And the reason why he did that, he likened it in an interview I saw to how like a true painter would never buy a flesh pink paint. They would buy a red paint and a white paint and, you know, orange paint and green paint, but like they would make their own paints. He was saying like his Hammond organ allows an organist to create their own sounds by putting together this basic stuff and creating something incredibly rich. And in fact, I think they calculated that there were 253 million possible tonal variations that you could come up with the Hammond organ.
Amazing. That's from 38 drawbars. Really, really cool.
Yeah, for sure.
Should we take a break or no?
I was going to say we should probably take a break.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. Let's do it.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at dell.com/welcometonow. Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today. So Hammond's organs took off really quickly. I think he sold 1,400 or something like that the first year. Imagine that, Chuck.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So, and I think they were originally about $30,000 today. I don't know how many drachmas, but they were $1,250 in the mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of money. Like, you had to be wealthy and you had to be really into music, or you had to have a church that was kind of wealthy to afford it. But that's who he marketed to, serious musicians, home musicians, professional musicians, but also churches more than anything. And it worked. Like, he sold 1,400 in the first year.
Yeah, George Gershwin, supposedly the first person to buy one, even though Henry Ford said he wanted the first six.
Mm-hmm.
But as the story goes, George Gershwin got the first. He's selling to, like you said, a lot of churches. I think, what was the number? Like, by 1965, more than 50,000 churches had Hammond organs. By 1938, there were 1,000 churches. But also baseball stadiums. If you've ever been to a baseball stadium, play those Hammond organs. Radio soap operas very early on,
mm-hmm.
you know, started, you know, if you remember like the dramatic music of a soap on the radio. That was an organ, a Hammond organ. So 1936, this is just 1 year into the Hammond organ. Things are really, really doing well. And the pipe organ industry starts complaining to the FTC. Mm-hmm. And they're like, this guy is out there making all these claims about how you can replicate every sound on a pipe organ, how it sounds the same as a $10,000 pipe organ. Mm-hmm. And like, these are false claims and he can't say that stuff. So the FTC started snooping around and they said, you know what? You can't make these claims. You can't say that stuff in your ads. And we're going to give you a cease and desist letter that says like what you can and can't say. Mm-hmm. And Hammond says, you know what we should do? We should have a blind listening test of, it's like a John Henry thing, like my little, I think it was a $2,600 organ that he used, mm-hmm. and a $75,000 pipe organ. And let's go head to head and have experts listen in and say what they think.
Yeah. So that's what they staged, I think, in 1936.
Yeah, well, I think that happened in 37, but he'd been fighting with the FTC for a while at that point.
Okay. So, yeah, that was exactly the kind of guy he was. He was exactly the kind of person to come up with a blind listening test to settle things with the FTC, you know? That's not how the FTC did things, but John Hammond kind of made them do it that way. And it was really, really risky because he would have been essentially guilty of unfair business practices, and that could have all sorts of terrible effects. But from what I saw, that they weren't going to let him use the name or the word organ for his instrument anymore.
Oh, really?
I'm guessing that would have had a pretty big damper on business as well. So he had a lot riding on this blind test, and it was very mavericky to suggest it in the first place. But in 1937, at the University of Chicago Chapel, they went head to head. They hid speakers, Hammond speakers, among the pipes, and put both the organ, the Hammond organ and the pipe organ behind screens, and they had 30 different little pieces of music, and each one played 15. And that panel of judges that you mentioned, they marked down which of those 30 they thought had played it, the pipe organ or the Hammond organ.
Yeah, and these were professional musicians judging. I think there were 9 of them. Most of them were organists, of course. And then he also had 15 college students. And he ended up basically winning. I think I saw different numbers of how much they were correctly identifying.
Yeah.
I saw they were wrong a third of the time. I saw they were wrong half of the time. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what happened was the FTC said, and this is 1938 by this point, so this thing's dragging out. They said, all right, here's a new cease and desist order. You can't say it can reproduce a $10,000 organ, because they could tell the difference there, but you know, they did find that produced like other words that we're using was that it sounded real, that it was produced fine music, that it produced beautiful music, mm-hmm. and he was able to use this wordage in all his ads moving forward, which he took as a big victory.
Yeah, oh, for sure, and I believe it was out of that battle where they calculated the 253 million different tonal sounds.
Oh, interesting.
And I believe they started using that for marketing, too, because if you ask me, if I'm just an ordinary Joe, mm-hmm. 253 million different tones mm-hmm. and makes as good a sound as a pipe organ, I'm going to be more wowed by the 253 million tones, even though the pipe organ makes 300 million different tones, because the pipe organ people aren't out there marketing to me like that, and John Hammond is.
So if you're a Joe keyboardist.
Yeah.
You see the value in this thing.
For sure.
I agree. Everyone talked about Joe the Plumber. No one ever talked about Joe the Keyboardist.
Oh, man, I forgot about Joe the Plumber. Good remember? Lord, that is a
Who
flashback.
Was that? Is that Sarah Palin?
I don't remember. But, man, if you're going to make a movie about the 2000-aughts,
right.
Having him, like, somewhere in the background would really be a nice touch.
Yeah, and Soy Bomb.
What was that?
Soy Bomb was the guy who rushed the stage in the, I think it was the Grammys during Bob Dylan's acceptance speech.
Oh, really? I don't remember that at all.
And he had a shirt on that said Soy Bomb?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, I can't remember the year. And I'm sure I got some of that wrong. But Soy Bomb, I know, is right.
It wasn't Bob Dylan. It was Bob Newhart.
That's right. When he won his Grammy. Mm-hmm. All right. So he's back selling these organs again. Famous people are using them. Baseball teams, stadiums are using them. soap operas in churches. Everyone's getting on board. A woman comes along by the name of Ethel Smith, who probably did more to popularize the Hammond early on than anybody else. Mm-hmm. She was in a movie, a Red Skelton movie called Bathing Beauty, mm-hmm. and played this song, and it's on YouTube. You should check it out.
Yeah, it's cool.
The lady's got crazy fingers. Yeah. She's so fast. Mm-hmm. And it was like a Brazilian kind of song called Tico Tico that became a smash international musical sensation.
Yes, and Ethel Smith was... She kind of idolized John Hammond because she realized what he had done by creating this Hammond organ. And so it was kind of symbiotic, even though she didn't meet him until much later. But she always kind of idolized him and was very grateful to him. Because, you know, without her or without him, she said she would have probably gotten into an older profession than music, if you
right.
know what she meant. And then without her, his organ just wouldn't have been as well known, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. That song was huge. Also, Jimmy Smith, the aforementioned, no relation to Ethel, jazz musician. Even though people before him used it, he really kind of took it to a new level. And then we have to talk about, because I know there are keyboard players and Hammond enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. They're like, guys, you can't talk about the Hammond organ without talking about the Leslie speaker.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to a show, a concert, and you've seen a Hammond organ, I almost guarantee you that sitting beside that organ is this giant brown wooden box that doesn't even look like a speaker because it doesn't have a big round grated panel like most speakers do. Mm. And you might be thinking, what in the world is that thing even? That is called a Leslie speaker, and it is the key, I think, to, and many people agree, to what makes the Hammond organ sound so amazing.
Yeah, and Don Leslie was like, hey, I came up with this speaker that works really well with your organ and makes it sound a lot better. Can I come work for you, or do you want to buy my idea? And remember I said at the outset that Hammond was kind of egotistical here or there, and he was also, I think you said, tone deaf. And apparently when you put those two things together, he wasn't at all impressed with Leslie's invention because he couldn't hear any difference, and he also, I think, didn't really like somebody telling him that they had come up with something that improved on his invention.
Totally.
So for decades, there was almost a one-sided Cold War between the Hammond Company, or specifically, I think I called him John Hammond, Larry Hammond, and Don Leslie and Leslie's company.
He spared no expense.
He would not entertain the idea of using these Leslie speakers in his organs. He wouldn't let anybody else do it. But they worked so well, Chuck, that if you were a Hammond dealer, an authorized Hammond dealer, you would secretly, like, if somebody came in and bought a B3 from you, you'd be like, let me show you something in the back.
Right.
And you'd take them back there and you'd be like, you really have to have this because it makes it so much better.
Yeah, he would even change the switches out from year to year so you couldn't use it. Like, you had to modify it, basically, to use with a Leslie. So the Leslie is really interesting. It's probably we should do a short stuff on it. But the secret to the Leslie is it's also electromechanical because it takes your sound, and instead of just pumping it out like a regular speaker, it shoots the sound in two directions. It shoots it down to a bass speaker that is literally rotating, and shoots it up to these two cones. They look like sort of like the old ear cones that you would put to your ear to hear somebody better if you were hard of hearing.
Right.
That were on what looks like kind of like a record turntable. Mm-hmm. And these things spin, and it would shoot the sound toward that, and the sound would spin through these spinning cones and come out the other side through the speaker. It did, you know, it's not like it didn't have any venting for sound. It had these little slits at the top,
right.
but not like a big, huge round hole.
Yeah.
And it was a belt-driven thing by a motor, and these things would spin, and it was variable speed. So if you had it really, really slow, it was sort of a warble. If you spun it really, really fast, it's that sound of classic rock that you know and love.
That's so awesome.
Or just rock and roll. If you hear a key pressed with that Leslie speaker spinning at top speed, it's that vibrato, that instead of just the and it makes a organ sound flat by comparison when you're not using one.
Right, I'll bet.
And really just brings it alive in a small space. So, you know, a pipe organ, one of the reasons a pipe organ sounds great is because it's used in a cathedral. If you're in your basement and you can't replicate a really great sound, this Leslie really aids in that.
The other thing it does is it serves as an alternate portal to Narnia. Once it gets spinning really fast, it tears right. open the fabric of time and space.
Yeah, so hats off to Don Leslie. You know, just a genius invention to go hand in hand. And I wish Larry Hammond had embraced it, but...
Oh, he did not.
Know, yeah, the ego got in the way, I think.
Even after he retired, he tried to prevent the company from doing business with Leslie.
Yeah, they're like, no.
basically, right when he died, they started adding Leslie speakers to their setups, which is pretty cool. So, Larry Hammond, I think I said John again. If I did, I'm sorry, everybody. I'm just going to move forward. But
those are good Easter eggs.
He was more than just the Hammond organ inventor and the tickless clock, the tick-in-the-box clock inventor, or the automatic bridge table inventor. He did all sorts of other stuff, too.
Yeah, he invented probably the first synthesizer. It's called the Novachord. You should watch YouTubes of this thing if you're into musical instruments, like old-timey ones. This was in 1939. Mm-hmm. Robert Moog was a 5-year-old who, you know, gets credit as being the synthesizer inventor. So he invented the Novachord. He invented all kinds of great stuff. I think he died after his death. He ended up with 110 patents to his name. CBS bought, he died in 1973. CBS had bought Hammond in 1965. Mm. They had also bought the Fender Guitar Company. So that's when CBS thought it was in the music instrument business for a little while. Mm-hmm. Hammond bought it back in 1980 from CBS. In 85, they went out of business. So like the last true Hammond B3, I think, rolled off the line in those years. And I think they made a couple of million organs. So it's not like if you want a Hammond B3 organ, you can find them today. Mm-hmm. They aren't cheap, but it's not like some huge rare collector item or anything like that.
One other thing I thought was noteworthy, Chuck, is a while back you talked about how he was like, you know, a good boss and he was very proud of employing people. Two different presidents of the Hammond Company started out at the bottom, one as an office boy and one in the mailroom, and worked their way up. That's, I mean, just having one president having done that is pretty impressive, but two is really significant. And really, I think it says a lot about the kind of company he built.
Totally. Suzuki, by the way, as a postscript, bought Hammond in 1989.
Right.
Suzuki of the motorcycle keyboard fame.
Sure.
And in 2002, they started making a new version of the B3 again. I think it's called the XK3. And I listened to a comparison. I'm sure keyboard players and purists will say, like, no, man, you got to have the original Hammond. But it sounded just like it to me. It's a little brighter, maybe.
They need to set up a blind listening test.
We should have at the Rockefeller Cathedral in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the XK3, it sounded pretty good to me.
Cool.
For my dumb semi-musical ear.
You got anything else?
I got nothing else. I enjoy these. I don't think we've done one on Moog yet, have we?
I don't think so. You keep saying Moog. It's very clearly Moog.
It's Moog.
I don't know.
But we should do him one day. I love covering these sort of pioneers in musical invention.
Yeah, it's a good little suite we're building. Okay?
Agreed. A sweet suite.
So Chuck said sweet suite, everybody, and as longtime listeners know, that just unlocked listener mail.
I'm going to call this a quick correction. Hey guys, love the show. Thanks for tackling the hard stuff. A quick correction from the Xenobiotics episode. Josh says during the explanation of PFAS that they get into the municipal wastewater and we have no idea how to get them out of our water. Mm-hmm. But that isn't true. Granular activated carbon and reverse osmosis are two ways to remove PFAS from water. Lots of drinking water treatment systems are currently using this technology as we speak to remove PFAS. Not saying they aren't expensive and difficult to manage, but they do exist. Keep up the great work, Whitney B.
Thanks a lot, Whitney B, with that bit of good news. I'm glad we can get PFAS out of our water.
Yes.
If you want to be like Whitney B and say listen to me, you can send it in an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.